right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a packed show today. At the back end of the show, we'll be continuing our coverage of the Palestine question, the Palestine situation, actually, the ferocious, just inhuman, basically genocidal assault by the Israeli regime, the Zionist State of Israel, against the Palestinian people in Gaza. And we'll be doing that by giving you some more background information on that. We'll be talking with the head of the Palestine Land Society, Salman Abu Sita. And Salman will be talking with us about the history of how the land was, in fact, stolen from the Palestinian people and what the situation is today. But then for the rest of the show, that's at the back end of the show, and then opening the show up and throughout the rest of the show, up until we get to that back end of the show, we'll be listening to different people talking about the war on women, and particularly as it's concentrated up in the war on abortion rights that's happening in Texas. Texas ground zero today in the war on women. We'll be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of women. And that piece is taken from a speech he gave back in 2003, which is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. But opening the show up is something that I've been paying quite a bit of attention to. One of the things that I've been following very, very closely is the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. And the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is something that, I mean, it's incredible when you look at what's happening. It's down in Texas, which is ground zero in the attack against women these days. It's focused up about around the all-out assault on the right to abortion. But even more than that, playing that out even bigger, the idea that the dehumanization and the degradation of women and the enslavement of women, which is all things that are sort of concentrated up in this. And joining us to talk about all this is Sansara Taylor, who's a frequent guest on the show. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org. And she's also part of the End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm very glad to be with you.
Great. Well, let's jump into this. Let's talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. What is it? Who's on it? And why Texas?
Well, I'm here in Texas. It is ground zero in a war on women. It's just one of many dimensions of why we need a revolution. Across the country, abortion rights are in a state of emergency. Clinics are closing. Women are being denied services. Women are being forced to have children against their will. They're being forced to risk their lives to self-induce abortions. This is going on nationwide in rural places, in poor places where the clinics have been closed and access is restricted. But here in Texas, about 2 years ago, there was 46 abortion clinics in the state. Last year, a severe, vicious, woman-hating law was passed by Governor Rick Perry in a special session after massive outpouring and protest. He ran this law through, and it has closed down dozens of clinics. It is scheduled to close all the clinics in the state except for six on September 1st in just a couple weeks. And so the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is people from across this country, young people, older people, people of every age group, every nationality, every gender, and different political perspectives. I'm a revolutionary and a communist like yourself. There's people coming from different perspectives. We're all standing together to say this is an emergency. Texas is ground zero in a national war on women, and it is everybody's responsibility across this country to come to the front lines, put our bodies on the line, and rally people to stand up and say we refuse to accept the foreclosing of women's lives. We refuse to accept forced motherhood, which is a form of enslavement. We've been out on the street rallying people, telling the truth, waking them up to the emergency, and involving them in building resistance against this.
Well, tell me this, Ansar, just so people are aware of this, what are the laws that are being put in there, or they're trying to put in into law right now? What are the laws? What are the stakes that are involved here?
HB 2 is the law in Texas, and it's kind of typical in some ways of a lot of the laws being passed around the country. But here in Texas, it has four provisions, all of them completely illegitimate. One of them is requiring that doctors who do abortions have admitting privileges with a local hospital. And this is just very difficult for doctors to get because a lot of hospitals are Catholic, a lot of hospitals cave to the pressure of anti-abortion fanatics and are refusing to grant admitting privileges to the doctors. And it's totally medically unnecessary. Abortion is 10 times safer than childbirth, and it's perfectly legal to give birth to a child in your own living room unsupervised. And in any case, a woman who, if there was a complication, hospitals have to admit a woman. They don't need admitting privileges set up. Hospitals, emergency rooms have to admit any emergency patient. So it's unnecessary medically on many levels, but that's one of the laws, and it's closed down many clinics. There's also a requirement that's requiring doctors to administer medication abortions in a very in a way that is no longer recognized as best practices. So it's putting doctors in a position where it's more difficult to administer the abortion pill, and it's less safe, and so many doctors are opting not to do that because it's not good patient care, so that's restricting that for women. And there's a ban on abortion after 20 weeks, which is outrageous because while most abortions occur early in a pregnancy, when women need an abortion in the later term of pregnancy, it's for one of two reasons. Either they've been kept so woefully ignorant about the workings of their own body that they didn't realize they were pregnant, or they did realize but they had no ability to get to a clinic because it's so difficult and so stigmatized, and women are a lot of them are very poor, or it's because it's only at 20 weeks in pregnancy that a lot of fetal abnormalities and other medical risks become discernible. And so they discover that there's something very wrong with the pregnancy that they wanted. And so even though it's a small percentage, it's a very important thing that women in the later months of pregnancy are allowed to access abortion. And the fourth part of the provision is a requirement that all abortion facilities meet the same physical standards as an ambulatory surgery center, which is basically a mini emergency room. Again, totally medically unnecessary, but financially out of the millions of dollars it will cost to overhaul these clinics. And so most of them will be forced to close. And this is a law that's being challenged. That dimension of the law is currently being challenged in a court hearing in federal court here in Austin, where I am, Austin, Texas. And we've been out at the hearing every day this week protesting against that law and supporting the abortion providers who are challenging that law in court.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, Sansara, as you're talking, it's sort of, you can see some people saying, okay, but yeah, but that's Texas, okay? So what does that have to do with the rest of this? You know, everybody knows Texas is whacked out. Is, you know, and people say that. They got Rick Perry down there, as you were mentioning earlier. They got all this stuff. They got all the kinds of, you know, militias and things like that that are trucking down to the border and doing it, you know, whatever, all this stuff. And people might say, but this is Texas. And you've argued that actually, yeah, it's Texas, but it's a whole hell of a lot more, too. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I think it is true. Look, we were at Rick Perry's house yesterday, and he's a fascist. He's a Christian fascist, a theocrat, a bigot. We also saw that convoy, the Murrieta anti-immigrant racist convoy, was down the block from us. A lot of stuff, I'll be careful, we're on the radio, a lot of stuff is flying down here in Texas that, you know, that is especially ugly. It's especially dangerous to people's lives, whether it be immigrants, whether it be women, whether it be a whole host of other things. But it's not the case that Texas and what happens here is so different than what's happening in the rest of the country, to be honest. Texas concentrates a lot right now of some of the ugliest dimensions of the reactionary fascist movement that's been whipped up in this country. But it's a part of a nationwide war on women. It's a part of a nationwide war on immigrants. It's a part of a nationwide move towards mass incarceration and a grinding up of Black and Latino youth in the prison systems. If only it was unique to Texas, then we'd have a much easier problem to solve. But everything that's happening down here, it's actually concentrating what's happening across the country. There are six states with only one abortion clinic left. When I was in Mississippi, when the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride was in Mississippi last year, we heard stories from women who used sharp objects to self-induce abortions. We heard stories from so many women who could not make it to the only clinic in that state and were forced to have children that they did not want, and now they're living in a car with a 2-year-old, 17-year-old girl living in a car with a 2-year-old. These are the stories. This is what's happening. It's not just Texas. And what happens here, whether these laws go forward and close these clinics down, and even more importantly, whether these laws go forward and everybody goes along and stays quiet, if that happens here, that sends a very negative dynamic. It actually doesn't set it. It allows a negative dynamic to accelerate across the country. But if people stand up here, if people raise their voices here, if people go into the streets here, if people tell the truth, that this is a fight that's never been about babies. It's always been about a fight to enslave women, and it's illegitimate, and we refuse to stand for it, and we are going to fight for abortion on demand and without apology as part of fighting for women's liberation. If they pass these laws and it's part of spurring forward massive opposition, that is part of strengthening a national movement to turn this around. And I do want to just highlight something that I think is really important for the listeners across this country, because what happens in Texas will affect women everywhere, and people across the country have a responsibility to weigh in and be virtual freedom riders with us while we're on the ground here in Texas, is we've been having these people's hearings. They're court cases across the country are deciding women's lives. We had a people's hearing to decide what really is the truth about women's lives and what needs to be done. We brought all these people together to tell the stories of what it was like before Roe v. Wade. And at stoppatriarchy.org, you can hear the testimony. Wednesday night, we had this woman get on stage, and people need to tune in at stoppatriarchy.org and watch this. She told of being a teenage girl in Mexico, growing up young, innocent, and poor. And she got invited to a friend's house to study. And when she got there, the guy said, "No, we're not here to study." He slammed the door. He pulled her down, and him and a group of friends who were waiting gang raped her. And she found out that she was pregnant. She was alone. She was ashamed. She had no one to turn to. She thought she had done wrong. And she was forced to bring into this world a child from that gang rape. She said for 35 years, this child looked at her and said, "Mom, who's my dad?" And she couldn't look him in the eye. She was forced to prostitute herself. She was forced to come to this country and clean people's homes for decades, for 35 years. She's never told this story. People's never heard this truth. This is not a Texas thing. This is what women face all over the world when they're denied the right to abortion and as a part of a whole system of enslavement and patriarchy against women. And we have heard those stories across this country. We are asking people to tune in and hear the truth and send in your stories and your testimony, the stories that have happened in your life or your family's lives, your grandmother's, things that people have lived through. There's nothing that unique about Texas except that it's on the front lines right now.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and part of StopPatriarchy.org, and she is also on the advisory board of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and they're in Texas right now, and Sansara is in Texas with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and that's where we're talking to her from. Sansara,
That's right. It's all down in Texas.
That's it. You got it. But it is and it isn't, as you said. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you just referred to something that you were talking about, you've written about in articles and whatnot, you've mentioned before, about this point about as bad as it would be if these laws go forward, it would be even worse if it goes forward without massive political resistance. And to me, I mean, the response that you've done with these people's hearings where women are coming up and others coming up and testifying about what happened before Roe v. Wade, what happens to them now, what life is like for a woman. I mean, there's all kinds of these things that I think is part and parcel of something very important, and that's I want people to understand what are the goals that you're trying to accomplish, including this idea of speaking out on a subject that sort of somehow has become forbidden to talk about or become, you only whisper it in the dark corners or in the alleys or whatever, but you can't get out there and say, look, you did an interview with a doctor who said, why can't we say abortion? It's a word. It's a medical word. Hello. And I think that, this thing of like what you're trying to accomplish, and especially in light of this, how much worse it would be if all this went through and there was not massive political resistance, and how you're countering that.
There's actually been quite a bit of controversy. I just want to be upfront with everybody about this. There's been quite a bit of controversy within the pro-choice movement about what we're doing with this abortion rights freedom ride. And one of the main things that people are saying is you can't, they don't like our slogan, abortion on demand and without apology. They think it's too extreme. It'll turn people off. Frankly, people are afraid. They've conciliated for decades with an attack on abortion that's called it murder, that's called women murderers, that have shamed women, stigmatized women, that's propagated all kinds of anti-scientific propaganda about the fetus being able to feel pain, all this stuff, which is totally untrue. And they've erased women from the picture. They've erased women. They always hold those pictures of a little fetus floating in the air. They erase the woman's body. Who's the woman who's that fetus is part of? They've erased women entirely. And this has been from a very theocratic assault trying to confuse people on the question of abortion. Unfortunately, we've also lived through 4 decades of conciliation with that on the part of pro-choice politicians, certainly Bill Clinton, Safe, Legal, and Rare, as if there was something wrong with abortion, as if it should be reduced. Hillary Clinton, who called it a tragic decision, which it is not. It can be a very positive and liberating decision, a very responsible decision to get an abortion. There's been conciliation on that level by the Democratic Party and by most of the pro-choice movement that has taken a lead from them, so that you hear the word choice, but you don't hear the word abortion. You hear all kinds, it's personal, it's health care. You find all kinds of ways people try to finesse and not talk about. This is about women's enslavement or women's liberation. This is about abortion and whether women will be able to decide for themselves when and whether to have children or be as enslaved to their reproduction. So the people who say that saying abortion on demand and without apology is too extreme, who consider themselves pro-choice, I have 2 questions. Which women do you think should be forced to have a child against their will? Which women should be denied abortion? And which women do you think should be made to feel ashamed or guilty for getting an abortion?
Boy, yeah.
And if you don't think that any woman should be forced to have a child or any woman should be made to feel ashamed, then you should join with us in fighting for abortion on demand and without apology. And when we take that out, we find two things. We find, one, that a lot of people agree with that and have been suppressed, made to feel isolated, made to feel defensive, and they feel like, finally, somebody's saying this. A young woman showed up with us to protest in front of Rick Perry's mansion yesterday, and she brought coat hangers and knitting needles and held them in the air. These are the instruments with which women took their lives desperately trying to self-induce abortions, and we won't go back. There are people waiting for this. And then there are other people for whom they've never heard this. And it does seem too extreme, and it does seem, oh, my God, you're so insensitive about this question. But you know what? It's good for them to hear it. It's good for them to hear something besides abortion is murder, and we can back it up. We can get into the science, and we can get into the substance of women's lives and why this matters, and we can change people's minds. We've seen that on the streets here in Texas. We've had those conversations. We're having them every day with people. We have volunteers going out, dozens of volunteers going out on the street every day talking to hundreds of people. We are finding people who agree and are coming and sharing their testimony courageously at these hearings, and we're finding people who are having their minds opened up and challenged and changed.
And when you think about this, I think it's important for people to really, and we got to hit at this and hit it again. It's important for people even who aren't in Texas but need to be following this. But also the idea that what you're creating in a lot of this is you're changing the whole terms of the discussion nationally. You're changing. You're actually bringing something out into the open. When I looked at what you hope to accomplish with this Freedom Ride, the point about launching a nationwide massive effort around this, a massive struggle around this, a coordinated national struggle, campaign or whatever, but also one that is actually changing the terms of things and the whole way things are looked at. And I was thinking about this as I read one statement from a young woman, I guess, who had spoken at one of the people's hearings. And she said something about women's lives are at stake, but so is the extent of what we are allowed to dream. When you're taught the fatal lesson that your body is not your own, you quickly forget how to dream in the first place. And I thought that captured so much of what needs to actually be busted through on.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll tell you, these volunteers, I just want to say, these are people of all ages, but especially some of these young volunteers, also especially some of the older volunteers who remember before Roe, so especially all of them. But I was going to say, these young people, they stand out. They shine right now in the world in terms of, they've learned some things. They've learned some things of what it really is going to be at stake for women's lives, and they're putting their bodies and their lives on the line behind that. They've uprooted themselves to live on the road in Texas for a month, to go into the teeth of these Christian fascists up against these laws, out to the people in a mass way every day, and it's like 100 degrees. They're in the hot sun. They're standing out there, and they're doing this with tremendous servitude because they understand what this means, and they're modeling something that I think should inspire. I mean, this is another thing you'll see if you watch StopPatriarchy.org, the people's hearings. You'll see their voices and their faces and their stories. They will inspire you. And frankly, many more people need to take their lead. We're told that to live a life that matters, you have to bow down on your knees and submit to some make-believe patriarchal God. That's where meaning comes from, or meaning comes from getting a lot of Facebook friends or getting a new pair of sneakers or buying the right things or all this material acquisition. This is about something that would really matter. These people are doing something that has tremendous meaning, not just for themselves, but for future generations and for women across this country and across the world. And there is such joy in that. There is such depth in that. There is such courage in that. And this is something that really people need to see. They need to support. There's financial support needed. The volunteers need to eat. They need money for gas. They need money for the car rentals. They need all of the materials that we're getting out. People could go and support. They could send in a message. It really matters. And you can be like them. People need to be like them. Whether you come down to Texas, there is still time. We're here the entire month. Come down to Texas or join with us for the Week of Defiance, August 25th through September 1st across this country. We are calling on people to join us in going into the streets with the pictures. We're bringing the faces of women who died from illegal abortions, and we're bringing them into the public so that people see them. They know what this fight is about. It's about women. We're waking others up, and we're rallying those who've been silent and on the sidelines for too long. And I really want to call on people to hear the voices, the one you were quoting from the young woman, and to take that example and to be like these volunteers, because the whole future is at stake. And we have a lot that we could do about it. We could shape the way that unfolds, but not if we sit at home.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and part of StopPatriarchy.org. And she is also on the advisory board of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and they're in Texas right now. And Sansara is in Texas with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. Sansara, I have one more question and about 3 or 4 minutes to have you answer it, maybe five. You wrote a very, I thought, very, very heavy personal piece about why you're doing this. And I thought it'd be good to talk about that for a minute, because it's both the immediate horror, fighting against the immediate horror, but also something bigger in terms of fighting to actually eventually be able to resolve this, to solve this thing.
Yeah, well, this is another thing that has been, not surprisingly, highly controversial. I myself first became politically active because I went up shortly after the first abortion doctor was assassinated in 1993. Not long after that, I had a chance to go up and defend the only abortion clinic in North Dakota. And I write about sort of why I did that and what motivated me, concern about women and doctors, and what I learned about the anti-abortion movement, how it actually has never been about babies. I heard them pray. I thought they were going to pray for babies. And instead they prayed, and I quote, "Lord, please break this curse of independence that has afflicted women." I got a firsthand sense of that this is about the desire, the biblically-based desire to control women, biblical literalist desire. I know there's a lot of Christians who support abortion rights, and we're working with some of them here, so let me be clear. But one of the things that's been controversial that I walked through in that article is that I learned this was more than a misunderstanding. I learned that this was part of a whole, this is rooted in a system, this war on women, and this whole setup of patriarchy and violence against women. And I became a communist and a revolutionary. And I walked through some of how that took place at revcom.us. And so one of the things that's been that the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride has been attacked, including by some mainstream pro-choice figures, saying, oh, there's communists involved, there's revolutionaries involved, there's people who support Bob Avakian involved. And I'll say, it is absolutely the case that I am motivated to be a part of this Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, to be part of fighting against the enslavement and degradation of women, because I see building this fight as a very important part of hastening the development of a revolutionary situation. I see it very much as part of waking people up to fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And I absolutely follow Bob Avakian, because he has re-envisioned how we could make a whole different world where we don't have to keep having generations after generations of girls raped, where men are socialized to see women as property, where people born across in other parts of the world, their countries are so destroyed by U.S. imperialism that they're forced to make that desperate trip across the border, across 1,000 miles, only to be rounded up and bullied and deported and treated like they're worse than dogs. This is not a world we should tolerate. It doesn't have to be this way. And Bob Avakian has fought and led a party to develop a strategy for revolution and a vision of a new society. And people, we need that. We couldn't have a revolution soon enough. And that's not a weakness, the fact that the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride involves communists and revolutionaries. It's a great strength. It's part of what makes us so passionate about this. It's also part of what makes us so passionate about standing shoulder to shoulder with people in this experience who are coming from very different perspectives, who don't necessarily want a revolution, who have a whole different vision of where they want it to go. But we're serious because it matters to women. And it matters to the future that we want to stand together with everybody. We want to learn from everybody in this process. We want to work side by side to stand up and stop and reverse these attacks right now. And so, you know, I invite people to come to revcom.us. We're covering the whole movement for revolution there, as well as the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, with analysis and putting it in a broader perspective. You can also go to stoppatriarchy.org and see the whole breadth of who's involved there and get involved yourself. But this is, like I said, this is, people think that's an attack. They're trying to attack. I think it's a tremendous strength, and I invite everybody to do the work, to take the responsibility, to learn for yourself, and to get involved and act on what you know.
All right, Sansara, and people can also tune into this show each and every week as long as this Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is going on, and we'll hear from you and others to give us updates on it, all right?
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, thank you, Sansara. Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, and we've been talking about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride that's currently in Texas right now. It's concentrating in Texas as the ground zero in the terrible assault on women in this country and by the system. All right. And before we move on, I want to give you a chance to hear some of the stories, a couple of the stories, to give you an idea of what's being broadcast and what you can hear and watch on the weekly People's Hearings that are being broadcast from deep in the heart of Texas, all right? And these broadcasts involve all kinds of people stepping forward to take up the fight against the war on women as it's being manifested and concentrated in Texas and the attack on abortion rights, all right? The first talk is from a woman named Frances who tells us about the horror of watching her young friend die from a botched abortion. And the second talk is from a young woman named Suzanne who's from Texas and who is a volunteer on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. This is Frances.
Hi. This goes back about 50 years ago, and for 50 years, I have kept this anger inside my body over my friends that died from illegal abortions. One particular person I want to speak about is my friend whose name was Tony, but everybody called her Tony the Boy Girl because she just happened to choose her lifestyle of loving women. And for this reason, she was raped brutally. And we came around her and talked with her and supported her. And then she found out that she was pregnant and she went for an illegal abortion. We went with her, but we weren't allowed inside. We had to sit outside on the stoop while she went inside. Worry, how is she going to be? What's going to happen? We're sitting outside, the door opens, and there she is, and we felt a sense of relief. We asked her how she was feeling, and she said, well, I've got really bad cramps. You know, once I get someplace where I can lay down, I'll be okay. So we went to take her someplace where she could lie down. As we're walking down the street, she just started hemorrhaging all over. We didn't know what to do. We're standing there. Tony, wake up. Tony, wake up. We're just a few blocks away from where you can lie down. And in a matter of minutes, she was gone. She was dead. This woman's life was stolen from her for daring to go up against the times then. And it has been a tremendous loss for all these years. So I want to say that I'm really, really glad that her story is being told. I think that this is so, so very important. And I also want to pull one line from a singer that I really, really like, Nina Simone. Her one sentence in one song is, "Say it loud, say it clear, for the whole round world to hear, abortion on demand without apology, forced motherhood is female enslavement."
And now this is Suzanne.
Hi, my name is Suzanne, and I am a new volunteer for Stop Patriarchy. I'm a young, hardworking woman, and I possess a lot of dreams and ambitions. I've been accepted into my college of choice, and I've gotten scholarships for it, and it's making it easier for me to pursue my future career as a psychiatrist. And like many people my age, I am sexually active. And I practice safe sex, but, you know, accidents happen. But I shouldn't be forced to throw away my life and my dreams because of one mistake. I shouldn't have to go through ridiculous complications for a legal abortion. And I should not be shamed for making decisions about my own body. And these restrictions on abortions in Texas, they have scared me so much that I felt I had to tell my best friend, "Girl, if I get pregnant, punch me as hard as you can in the gut." I should never have had to ask that of a friend. I should never tell her, "I need you to do that for me if something happens," because I'm terrified of all the stuff I'm going to have to go through for an abortion in Texas. But I'm not just here for me. I'm here for all the women in my position, all the young women out there who have dreams, who are going to college, who have careers, because they all deserve the best in life, and they deserve to have their choices respected. They deserve to have a choice.
All right, welcome back. Those were two samples of the kinds of things you'll hear at the People's Hearings, which are broadcast from deep in the heart of Texas by StopPatriarchy.org and the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, all right? And if you want to find out more information about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, you can go to stoppatriarchy.org. You can also go to revcom.us, which is also at both of those places. You'll also be able to watch the weekly people's hearings every Wednesday evening night. And then it's up there for you to catch as you can. If you can't get there as they're being broadcast live, catch up on it later. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this excerpt is all about the oppression of women and the fight against it. So stay tuned.
It was 8:49 on a beautiful ninth day of July. There was not a cloud to speak of, so the orange sun hung lonely in the sky. I lay prone in my cabby home, thinking of fine nappy Jackie and his jazz cat's horn. Sliding in a tape of bird on verb when suddenly rang my phone. Hey, butterfly, the voice said, slip on some duds, comb out your fro, and slide on down to my pad. The vibe here is very pleasant, and I truly request your presence. A problem of great magnitude has arose, and as we speak it grows. Damn, what could it be, I thought, a juice I bought, and rolled on down to her spot. Seeing bros I know slapping fives, I arrived and pressed G5. And there was Nikki, looking some kind of sad with tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a verb, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate. Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose.
But all right, welcome back. And that was Diggable Planets with La Femme Fatale. All right, La Femme Fatale. Okay, it's a rarity these days. A pro-abortion song, all right? A pro-women's right to choose song. You don't find too many of them out there now, so love the ones you find, all right? All right, we're going to move real quick right into the next segment of the show, which is listening to an excerpt of a speech by Bob Avakian, and this excerpt is taken from the Revolution Talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and what it's all about, and you can find that at revolutiontalk.net.
And what about the situation of women in this greatest of all countries? Having to live in a man's world, that is, a world of male supremacy, a world of rape and sexual assault. Think of this fact. Between one-fourth and one-third of all women in the U.S. will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. A woman is raped almost every minute in this country. Now, this makes me think of something that the great African-American novelist and writer Richard Wright put into the beginning of one of his books, Big Boy Leaves Home. It's a story also that begins in the rural South. It's a story of some young black boys who go out for have a little fun on one day. They go down for a walk by the river. They're having fun with each other the way kids do. They're laughing and playing. They're walking along the edge of the river, and all of a sudden they take a turn in the river, and there is a white woman bathing in the river. And suddenly they're struck with terror, because they know through no fault of their own, and purely by the accident of making that curve in the river, their lives are now in danger, that they could be lynched just for coming upon this white woman in this way. And this same kind of situation exists for women throughout the society. You go shopping. Maybe you have to go at night because you work during the day. You come out of the store. If the lights aren't working in the parking lot, or if you're parked in the wrong place, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you're walking down the street and there's a place there that's a little bit hidden where somebody could be hiding, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you go the wrong place at the wrong time, or if you do something that some asshole says means you asked for it, you could be attacked and raped. Now, Elaine Boozler is a comedian. She got at this point in a way of using humor to illustrate a very serious and deadly thing. She told about how, in one of her routines, she told about how she came out of a movie with a male friend of hers, a good friend, and he said, "Oh, it's a beautiful night. Why don't we go for a walk down by the river?" And she said, "Well, maybe it's safe for you, but I don't think I'm going for a walk down by any river. It's late at night, it's dark, and I'm carrying a vagina." Now, this is a way to use humor to make a deadly serious point. And another cold statistic captures a real horror lived by women every day. A woman is battered in the U.S. every 15 seconds. And by far, this is done most often by their boyfriends or husbands, who have been trained and conditioned to view these women not as equal partners, but as something like their property, their possession, and a breeder of their children. For most of the time the United States has existed, and even within the lifetimes of many people still alive today, there were laws in many states in the U.S. which, in terms of the rights of persons, did not include women in the category of persons with these rights. And these laws and the customs that went along with them openly treated women as inferior and subordinate to their husbands and to men in general. As I pointed out in the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, up until less than 20 years ago, there were still states in the U.S. where there was no such thing as marital rape, where a husband could legally force his wife to have sex with him whether she wanted to or not. And for most of the history of this country, this was a situation for wives in general. And then there is the move, backed and encouraged from the highest offices of the land, to keep cutting back and ultimately to take away from women the right to have an abortion. Upholding and fighting for the right of abortion is a crucial part of fighting for the emancipation of women in the fullest sense. It is a crucial part of freeing women from every form of domination and oppression by men, breaking the chains on half the human race, enabling women to take part fully and equally in every sphere of society, and in the struggle to radically change all of society. Denying women the right to abortion, denying them the right to decide when or if they will have children, with everything that means and all the effects that will have on their lives. Denying this is like battering and rape. Denying the right to abortion is a means of exercising forcible control by a male supremacist society over the very lives of women and over their bodies.
Welcome back. You've been listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian focused up on the oppression of women. And that excerpt is taken from the speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. All right? And you can find that at revolutiontalk.net. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Salman Abu Sita from the Palestine Land Society. So stay tuned.
Why didn't you bomb the tracks, Jack? Why didn't you block them trains, Jane? Why didn't you bomb the tracks, Jack? You should have stopped the trains, Jane. You know you should have. You know you could.
All right, welcome back. And that was Chucky Weiss with Bomb the Tracks from his latest album. All right. And this week, in continuing our coverage of the Israeli genocidal assault against the Palestinian people, their assault on Gaza, I wanted to dig back into something that's very fundamental to understanding what's behind all this and what's the nature and character of the Israeli state and the Israeli assault against the Palestinian people, an assault that is obviously at this point completely backed up 100% by the U.S. imperialists and all of the other imperialists in the world as well. All right. And the fundamental fact here is that Israel was formed solely on the basis of stealing the land from the Palestinian people. So I decided that I'd go back and talk to someone who's been deeply involved in and knowledgeable about the original land seizure of Palestine by Zionist forces backed up by various imperialist powers around the world, including, most essentially, the U.S. imperialists. Now, to start things off, I'm going to read a few sentences from an article recently written by my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and director of the Palestine Land Society. In May 2012, Senator Mark Kirk made an astounding discovery which had escaped scores of politicians, diplomats, and experts for six decades. He discovered that the number of Palestinian refugees is not 5 million, as United Nations Relief and Works Agency records show, but merely 30,000. The credit for this discovery goes to AIPAC and Israel, as they had advanced this so-called discovery for the last 4 months. Kirk took the signal and proposed a motion to Congress, which was passed after a mild amendment. Dispossessed Palestinians will remain dispossessed Palestinians with no recourse. Those are the words of my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. Salman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Let's jump right into this. When I read your article, it was like sticking a pin in my eye. I paid a lot of attention to what's going on with the Palestinian people, and then seeing this just drove home again this whole question of the dispossession of the Palestinian people, and I wanted to talk with you about it. You make the point, you say it's impossible to examine the Palestinian land ownership in occupied Palestine outside the context of the general Palestine-Israel conflict. Can you explain what you mean there and why you say that?
The tragedy of Palestine is very clear. In 1948, Israeli forces, mainly composed of Jewish immigrants from Europe, took over Palestine by force, by military force. They have depopulated 675,000 villages within 6 months of 1948. Thus, we have the problem of refugees. The purpose of Zionism is threefold. Number one, to take over the land of Palestine. Two, to get rid of the people of Palestine by resettlement anywhere else except in their homes, is to erase their history and memory. And so we have in this case the largest, most comprehensive, meticulously executed ethnic cleansing in modern history. And this problem persisted today. 64 years later, the Palestinians are unable to go back and live in their own homes. The land, which is called Israel today, 93% of it is Palestinian-owned. And this is the land of the refugees who are now scattered around Palestine and elsewhere.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, because you just made the statement that this, the expulsion of the Palestinian people, the seizure of the land, the theft of the land, was the largest planned, comprehensive, and still continuous ethnic cleansing operation in modern history. Can you get into that a little bit more? How did that play out?
In 1948, the Israeli forces occupied 78% of Palestine. In 1967, they occupied all of Palestine and parts of Syria and Sinai and later part of Lebanon. Now they still have 100% of Palestine and all Golan Heights in Syria. Now the whole world, through the international community, has declared that this is illegal under international law. The International Court of Justice has made a specific decree that the occupation of the West Bank by Israel, and indeed all of Palestine, is illegal under international law. There are more than 135 UN resolutions confirming or affirming the right of Palestinians to return to their homes, but Israel never complied with that, although it is a condition for its membership in the United Nations. Why it didn't do that? Because of the support of the United States through the Israel lobby in the United States.
Now, one of the things, though, it wasn't like they just walked in and started buying up the land, or they started just telling Palestinians, well, sorry, but we own your house now, you got to get out. When you're talking about ethnic cleansing, you're talking about something that actually is a crime against humanity. It's actually something that the Nuremberg Tribunal basically said that this was a criminal act. And the Israelis were very, very, very vicious in the cleansing of Palestine. You refer to something in one of your pieces, you refer to something called the Green Patrol, which gave me a very sharp example of how they carried this out. Can you tell my listeners what the Green Patrol is and what it had to do with ethnic cleansing?
Before the Green Patrol, which started in 1950, in 1948, the Israelis carried out 31 military operations to take over 78% of Palestine. In each of these operations, at the beginning and in the middle, they have committed a massacre of a village, a total of about 77 atrocities and massacres. This was intended to propel the people and make them leave their homes. In fact, each village, the standard procedure was that each village was surrounded from three times, and the fourth side is left open for people to escape. They would kill a number of young men, and they take the rest to concentration camps where they were taken to forced labor camps. We have uncovered five visited by the Red Cross, and we have the documents in Geneva to prove it, but we have also uncovered 17 other forced labor camps through the testimony of the witnesses. Now, all this was carried out in 1948-49. If anyone tried to return home, they were shot and killed by the Israelis as being infiltrators. If you return to your home, you are an infiltrator. But the one who came from Europe through the shores of Palestine, infiltrated into the land of Palestine, is not considered to be an infiltrator. Now, after 1950, some Palestinians remained, very, very few, or almost 10 or 15%. When these people remained on their own land, the Israelis created something called Green Patrol, which went around and demolished their houses and actually put toxic material in their crops and killed their cattle in order to make them move. These were and are Israeli citizens. That happened after 1948, and these people were not refugees, but Israeli citizens. So this process, as you have said, is continuous until today. Today is course to carried out not only inside Israel, in Al-Araqib, in Beersheba district, but also in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it plays out in these examples. For instance, one thing that we hear a lot about is the so-called Israeli settlers that move into the occupied territories and then claim them as their Holy Land, their promised land, and they get backed up by the military. And there's a constant confrontation with the Palestinian people who are saying, no, get out. Do you see this as a continuation of that same ethnic cleansing?
It is absolutely a continuation. It is done today through slightly different means. Instead of being military force in 1948 and 49, it's done now by subtle ways and not so subtle ways. Let us remember that the International Court of Justice in 2004 has clearly declared that the occupation of the West Bank is illegal under international law, and that means under the Rome Statute of 1998, which is the foundation of the International Criminal Court, declares clearly that the people of the occupier or the occupying force should not be settled on the occupied land. If they do, this is, of course, a crime against humanity, a crime against peace, and a war crime. Therefore, legally speaking, all the settlers in the West Bank are war criminals. And the Israelis deny that the West Bank is an occupied territory. They are the only people who claim that. Even the United States doesn't claim that. The whole world claims it is an occupied territory. So here you have not only the settlers taking Palestinian land in the land that was occupied in 1967, but also they take their water. 90% of the water of the West Bank is taken over by the Israelis, and they are left thirsty. Not only that, even South Africa did not dare to do that. They have Jews-only road. If you are a Palestinian in the West Bank, you are not allowed to drive on roads allocated for Jews. When Bishop Desmond Tutu visited, he said, I know apartheid very well, but this is in the West Bank and Palestine. This is worse than apartheid.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and people of Palestine. And we're talking about the ethnic cleansing that is a continuous thing going on in Palestine and the Zionist forces behind it from the very very beginning. Now, Salman, you talked about this, the objectives of the Zionist master plan of ethnic cleansing, and you went through them, the land to conquer it, confiscate it, deny its original ownership, the people to kill them in massacres, expel them, chase them into exile, or make their lives unbearable. There's also this thing about the identity, and to erase any physical sign of the Palestinian presence, destruction of villages, monuments, holy sites, to change maps and delete Arabic names and replace them with Hebrew names, and erase their mention in history and geography books. And I noticed that a lot of your writing really concentrates on trying to combat that. Why is this so important? Why did the Zionists go after this so hard?
Well, from the beginning of the 20th century, the Zionists have sold the European politicians, colonial politicians, the idea that Palestine is a land without people, and the Jews are people without land, therefore let us get the two together. Now, this is a myth, and this myth was well known to the colonial powers themselves, the British and the French, because in the 19th century, they made surveys of Palestine, and they found, we have all the maps today, they found that there are 1,000 towns and villages in Palestine, and some of them are actually recorded and known since the times of Jesus Christ. Now, why do they do that? Because they wanted to prove that they have not committed a sin or a crime against anybody. This is an empty territory. Now, we have to show that this is, of course, entirely false. So I worked for almost 20 years collecting documents from various European capitals, but mainly England and the United Nations and New York, Washington, in order to reconstruct the maps of Palestine, which has been erased by the Zionists. We have great difficulty because we are not yet a state, and I'm only a researcher, and therefore I have no authority to demand documents from government. But over 20 years, we have assembled the Atlas of Palestine, 1917 to 1960, 700 pages. It has the following. It has 1,600 towns and villages. It has 16,000 historical and religious monuments, and it has 26,000 place names. All these names, a total of about 50,000, are what I call the vocabulary of the social history of Palestine. It was not created by committee. It was created by the people in their course of life. For example, the Pigeon Valley, the Olive Fields, and so on and so forth. And this is, to me, a great testimony of the life of the people who have been rooted in Palestine for thousands of years. When Ben-Gurion was told that we have taken over Palestine and people will not accept it, he said, the young will forget and the old will die. Well, they all did die, but not before they tell their children about their patrimony, and the Atlas is a record of this patrimony.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, and we're talking about the dispossession of the land and people of Palestine. Now, Salman, we have a couple of questions left to ask, and one is, there's always the thing that the U.S. imperialists are always putting out to people and always putting out around the world, and the Israelis are right behind them and pumping it out. The only democratic regime in the entire Middle East, you know, whatever. The whole idea that the people who are living in Israel and in occupied Palestine, that they have recourse to legal rights. Yet, I'd ask you this. The situation, as you say, continues to be ethnic cleansing. What legal recourse do the Palestinian people have today in occupied Palestine, in what the Zionists call Israel?
You know, let me say this. Israel is the only racist country in the world today. There are many countries which practice racism in a subtle way and in a social way. But Israel is the only race country through its institutions and through its laws. There are 25 basic laws in Israel, at least, which discriminate against anyone who is not a Jew. Even though, and this applies to Jews who are not also citizens of Israel, they have the same rights like Jews who are in Israel. These basic laws discriminate against anybody who is not a Jew in the following manner: in the land ownership, in the land use, in education, in health, in employment, in family unity. If you are married to a Palestinian woman from the West Bank, you cannot bring your wife to Israel if you are Palestinian living there. But a Jew can bring an Australian or an American wife or anywhere from anywhere to Israel. The world has condemned Israel so many times in the Human Rights Council, And only last week, CERD, which is the Committee for Elimination of All Traces of Racism, has censored Israel very clearly about its practices. And this practice is continuing on today. You probably recall the case of a village called Araqib in Beersheba, and the Israeli government demolished the village for over 36 times. And this is obviously has been also condemned by European Parliament only last week. So Israel has the dubious distinction of being the most racist state in the world. The people in Europe and somewhat in America have, because of internet and television and so on, have really seen the reality behind the myth that Israel is democracy. 70% of people in Europe say that Israel is a danger to the world peace.
Let me ask you this, Salman. Real quick, you made a comment in a couple of your writings, in a couple of places, you made the comment that the Palestinians cannot depend on the Israeli legal system because Israeli law is the law of the conqueror, and it's designed to deprive the vanquished of their rights. And you also made a similar point around international law. Can you talk about that a little bit as the last question?
Yes. There is a simple adage which we can find somewhat useful here. I say, under the robber's law, you cannot retrieve the stolen goods. And this has been proven over and over again. But if you allow me, just let me say one thing before we go. There is now, by the Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters in the United States, a vicious campaign against UNRWA. Why is that? Because UNRWA is the last element of the international law about Palestine, which is in operation. And as in a typical crime, if you find the body of the victim, then there is a crime. So the Israeli supporters are trying to eliminate the body of the victim. And if there is no UNRWA, there is no refugees, and therefore there is no crime. And this, of course, is a vain hope because Palestinians are not only 5 as registered with the United Nations, but they are 7.4 million because some of them are not registered. And I have shown this in the Atlas because it's very simple exercise. The British have made a census in 1945, and we have the names of villages from which people were expelled, and we can know these villages and the population they're from. And we can calculate that. It is found in one of my books called The Nakba Register. And the fact that they have stayed 64 years away from their homes and they have no intention of abandoning their right to go to their homes, which are very frequently a few miles away, then the peace can never come to the Middle East without the return of the refugees to their homes, which is a basic and fundamental human right.
Okay, Salman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, and keep up your work, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, a group dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. All right, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a little piece from Thievery Corporation, which I think captures some of what we're up against today and some of where we got to be headed, all right? It's called Sound the Alarm. Sound the alarm.